Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Well, certainly I think that there is no doubt that what occurred came about because of racism, white supremacy. You have a young adult black, white male saying that he wanted to kill black people, and saying black men rape white women, and that black people were taking over the country. I don't know whether he was making reference to the fact that the country is supposed to now be run by the first black president. And so, without a doubt, this falls within our understanding of racism, white supremacy, certainly. But as I have watched the programs on CNN and other channels, I really found myself, because of people at the church and many other people commenting, political figures and television figures were talking about how wonderful it was that black and white people were together in the church, and the black and white people were singing "We Shall Overcome" and holding hands and swaying back and forth. And I found myself feeling nauseated, if I really speak the truth, and disgusted. And I just thought that after Ferguson, you have black and white people marching together, and then you have another event. You see, and then you have the events in Baltimore, and you have black people and white people marching together, and everybody's saying how wonderful that people are getting together. And I jotted a note down, and Monday, this is Thursday, and by Monday, everybody will be back again playing their part in the system of racism and white supremacy, either as people who classify themselves as white or the people that the whites classify as the black people who are the victims of racism and white supremacy. And I know that people hearing me might say, oh, how can she say that? Isn't it wonderful? The people are all holding hands like Martin Luther King wanted them to do. You see, but the very fact that we go from event to event, and I'm certain that because this young man not only killed black people, but, I mean, it's just disgusting that there were 6 black women and 3 black men who were killed, and an 87-year-old black woman was killed. And I said, when are we as black people going to have the level of self-respect and courage to really come out of the slave role slave, obey your master, turn the other cheek. Make certain you turn the other cheek and you'll get your reward in heaven. And that's a slave role. We haven't maybe thought about it in those terms. But, for example, people never, and they'll, you know, there'll be black people coming forward and saying they forgive the shooter, that they forgive and they think this is a thing to do. I mean, that's the cycle of events as far as we are concerned. And I said, no, this is highly incorrect.
Context of white supremacy. I was waiting for the end of the clip, and then it ended. But she was saying black people coming forward to forgive the shooter. The words of Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, that was an audio snippet from her visit, I think, not just one of the most important times that she visited us on the cows. She did 31 appearances on this broadcast, but I think one of the most important programs that we've done 24 hours after the massacre in Charleston, South Carolina. I have played that segment before. Certainly you can go in the archives and hear the full program. But I try to remind folks that that was within 24 hours of the shooting. That was before the court appearance where everyone talked about, and where some of the victims in the shooting were saying that they still forgave Dylan Stormroof after everything that he had done. That was before that had even taken place, where Dr. Welsing was giving her assessment about, you know, how she thought things were going to go and her thoughts about what she had seen just, you know, within the first few hours of this act of white terrorism. Today's date, Tuesday, February 16th, 2016, so I have been told. As I said right at the beginning of the year, we certainly were going to invest a significant amount of time just remembering, and not just, you know, people pay their respects and what have you, and talk about people after they have transitioned, but I especially think with any black person who invested their energy, their life force in trying to do something about racism, white supremacy, it shouldn't just be, you know, well, let's talk about this person or share some stories. It should really be, what was this person trying to do about racism, white supremacy? What can we learn from their efforts, and what of value that they share with us in the time that they were on this planet, can we use? Should we appreciate? And when we appreciate something, meaning we take that, we apply it to our thoughts, speech, actions, and emotions to help us solve this problem. And I'm pretty sure that Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, that is what she would want us to do, to take her writings, the many lectures. I've said that consistently over about the last month and a half. She left so much work. She would really want us to study her work and apply her teachings if her life, her efforts meant something to us. In that vein, on the program today, just a real honor. I think several of our listeners have been able to go and attend some of the different services that they have had, memorials to Dr. Welsing that have taken place since the beginning of the year. And one of our listeners, I think he was able to attend the service that they had in Chicago, Illinois, recently. Dr. Welsing, she talked about her time growing up in Chicago and how that impacted her understanding, talked about it repeatedly on this program. He was able to reach out to one of her sisters. And that's something that I also think is important to keep in mind, that, you know, we kind of knew her from her public appearances and certainly her book, The ISIS Papers, The Keys to the Colors, and folks seeing her in Hidden Colors or seeing her on Donahue or different public spaces. But at the end of the day, you know, she was someone's daughter, someone's sister. She had family and friends, people that cared about her and knew her before, you know, she ever got to that point. Just a real privilege to have on the program her sister to talk about some of the things that she remembers. Her understanding of racism, her own efforts in fighting against racism, white supremacy, just a real privilege to have her on the program, joining us live from Washington, D.C. Miss Lauren Cress Love. Miss Love, are you with us?
I am with you, and I really thank you for inviting me to be a part of this program. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. The privilege is all ours, and I'm sure I can speak for our listeners first and foremost. We are immensely sorry for your loss. We have definitely felt it ourselves, but for you and Dr. Welsing's entire family, we hope that you all are healing and taking care of each other as best you can. You all definitely have been in our thoughts and prayers for months now.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that. It is a difficult time for our family, for me, for our family, but I think that we're all family. And it's interesting that I've learned more about my sister since her death in a way than I have known about her for actually 80 years. We are, I'm the oldest of three girls in our family. Frances and I are 11 months and 13 days different. Her birthday is the 18th of March, and I'm the 31st of March. So between the 18th and the 31st, we're the same age. And that had many ramifications growing up. But Frances left home in 1951 when she went to Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio. And when she finished Antioch, she went to Germany, which she may have talked about at some point on your program, LeVar, because she wanted to understand what had happened to Jewish people and who were these people who had ultimately sent them to concentration camps. And I think that I would not say that was the beginning of her interest at all in racism, but that certainly had much to do with it. When she returned from Germany and went to Howard University to medical school, she had essentially left our home, although she was certainly back for, you know, vacations and different family holidays or Thanksgiving, Christmas, other opportunities to come to Chicago. And she spent her internship in Chicago at Cook County Hospital. But essentially, and I had not thought about this until this time span, essentially, she had left Chicago so that she became a Washingtonian in that sense. She spent the rest of her life in Washington, D.C. And so then people here in Washington, that's where I am now, trying to take care of some of her business, but there are people here who saw her more frequently than we as family did. And certainly through her institute, the Cress Welsing Institute for Psychiatry and Social Research, which operated for over 30 years, the second Thursday of each month, more recently at Howard University Blackburn Center, she had students who have studied with her for 20 years, 25 years, sat at her feet and really listened and learned. So in a certain kind of way, other people, the public, in a sense, knows more about her in that way and also more about her theory, because as family members, we heard her when she was in Chicago, which was really rare. I had said to her, often, I wish you would come to Chicago and start an institute, or I wish you would come to Chicago maybe four times a year, because we need to understand you, to understand the theory, your theory more in depth in Chicago. But that never did happen. And a lot of times when she did come to Chicago, she really wanted to rest. So many people in the District of Columbia, here where I am now, and other places who sat at her feet learned more about her in a certain kind of way than I did. But then on the other hand, we were sisters. We grew up together. We went to elementary school together and high school together. We took piano lessons at the same time. We took dancing lessons at the same time. We took dramatic arts together. All of those kinds of things that children do in a family, we did together because we were so close in age. Frances was of the two of us, she was certainly a genius. I am not a genius, but she is and was a genius. And as I've listened to people talk about her, I have understood that more than perhaps I did. You know, she was my sister. And you probably don't, you know, oh, she's really smart. Well, we always knew that she was really very intelligent. But I did not really see her really as a real genius until I had to come in her home and be among her papers. Frances was constantly thinking, constantly writing notes, constantly interpreting the environment, constantly interpreting the news. Her house is full of yellow pads of paper with notes and ideas written, newspaper articles, papers folded, underlined on articles that related to her sense and her theory of racism, white supremacy, and also of the world. So she really, she was a giant. And I said that a week ago Friday in Chicago, there was a memorial for her on the 6th of February. And the day before at the Center for Inner City Studies, they had Dr. Colby Caban did an analysis of her work and how it affected the thinking, especially of black psychologists, and how he says that she turned things, thinking around. But so I was asked to make some remarks, and I said that the great Frances Cress Welsing, the great Frances Cress Welsing, and I realized that we do not give enough acknowledgement to our thinkers, to those people who have put themselves on the line to make a difference in the lives of African Americans. And certainly Frances was one of those, but there are many others in the past, Asa Hilliard, Dr. John Henry Clark, Dr. Ben, all of these people who are almost screaming at us to listen, to read, to understand what they are saying so that we can improve our lives and so that we can get out of this mess that we're in. But I think sometimes we don't take people seriously enough. You know, we say, oh, yeah, well, I got the ISIS papers. But I say, have you read the ISIS papers? Have you really, really analyzed that book, analyzed each chapter, understood what she was saying, as well as the work of many other great thinkers? So I think that we have a lot of work to do. We have to become much more serious about the dilemma that we find ourselves in, because racism, white supremacy is not just an idea. It's not just a few words. It is an activity that is impinging even more on us than I think in some ways that we have known before. We are being forced out of the cities. We're being forced out of urban centers. And sometimes, I don't know if we're talking about that. I'm listening to people in Washington, D.C., which I don't know what the African-American population is in this city now. But I lived here for over 20 years, and I moved to D.C. in the early 70s. In the 1970 census, the District of Columbia was 70% black. But it was also 70% rental housing. So what that means and what that meant was that even though there were 70%, black people were 70%, and people were proudly saying, oh, this is the chocolate city, the chocolate city, it really wasn't, because we didn't own 70% of the homes. We only rented. And so when it was time to move on the black population and to begin to force them out of the District of Columbia, it wasn't all that hard, because people could just take back their, white folks could take back their homes. So this means that people are being forced out into suburbs. This means that the voting rights that we had established will be weakened. This means, and this is happening all over the country, this means that within a few years, we're going to have fewer and fewer African Americans in political office representing us. We will be in little pockets in the suburbs where we are disconnected, and we will become even more powerless than we are. So these are certainly some of the things that my sister looked at, that I'm looking at, that others are looking at, and we're all saying, you know, let's wake up. Wake up. Wake up, black people.
Context of white supremacy. Before I even get to my next question, just because she said it so many times, reading is more important than watching television. She would definitely echo those sentiments probably several times. One of the things, every time she came on this program practically, I would introduce her and emphasize she is a third-generation physician. And I think sometimes that kind of gets lost on people, like what that means about her parents, grandparents, and the influence that they had, not just on her, but on you as well. Can you talk about the Kress family, your grandparents and parents, that influenced Dr. Frances Kress Welsing, your sister?
Well, yes. You know, I would say that in a certain kind of way, our family was somewhat unusual. But I would also say that we never thought of it in that way. You know, as most people, you're born into a family, and that's just who and where you are. You don't necessarily see yourself juxtapositioned to other people in the community. Our mother was a Chicago public school teacher for 45 years, actually, and our father was a physician. And he practiced for, I would say close to 40 years. Now, but his father was also a physician, and we did not know that grandfather. Our father was named Henry Noah Kress, and our grandfather was Henry Clay Kress, who was born in North Carolina and came to Chicago to medical school. Now, our grandmother always told us that grandfather was what is called, and was at the time called, a race man. And this is a term that is given to, not so much now, but at that time, given to people who fought for the race. And our grandfather and my grandmother always said that he spent more time fighting for the race than he did practicing medicine. And he died when our father was like about 5 or 6 years old, so our father never really knew his father. But I contend that Francis is channeling that grandfather, who was a race man. Well, she was certainly a race woman, and she spent as much time or more time fighting for the race than she did perhaps practicing medicine. But I wouldn't say that, because in her practice, she used her theories of racism, white supremacy, in helping people handle and understand what they were confronting in daily life and what things were impinging on them that affected their life. And so many people have said, and I've heard them, or they've said, I've heard them on air, people have said to me, who were her patients, how much she helped them to understand the situation that they found themselves in. And this is really one of the things that's happening now in Washington, D.C., where many people work for the federal government and where they are being forced out of their jobs by people who are maligning them on their jobs, criticizing them, setting them up for failure. And so Francis, but this has been going on, this is part of living in America, but it's become more pronounced now because this is a takeover of this city, or a taking back, let's say, of this city. But I'm certain that people in other parts of our country are beginning to see this and find this to be true. So, Francis, in our family, we were even though, let's say, our parents were, quote, professional people, we were never told to think that we were superior to anyone else, that just because we may have, when we had the baseball bat and a ball and a swing in the yard, that meant that we were somehow better than other people. That was not the attitude of our family. Another thing is that on our mother's side, our great-grandfather, who was living in Canada in the 1800s, came from Canada to Chicago, and where there was a Union Army base, and joined the Union Army and fought in the Civil War. So, we didn't know about that for years in our family. It was not something that, was bragged about. But somehow that kind of intention within a family or within a group spills out in different ways. So our mother, after she retired from Chicago Public Schools, for one thing, she never stopped working. She died in her 90s and had something like Alzheimer's, but many people said, well, Lauren, I don't think your mother really has Alzheimer's, because when I talk to her, she's, very lucid. But she, one of the things that she did was to organize a campaign, her own campaign, about keeping Chicago clean. And so she had her own buttons made, and she talked to children and young people and in the neighborhood and beyond about picking up the trash in front of your house and other things to make your community a better place to live. And certainly one of Frances's, if you know her, stops. One of her stops is stop throwing down paper and trash in areas where black people have to work, live, and play. So that's a little bit about our family background and where some of the influences, perhaps, on Francis Cresswell's. Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Amazing. Just just to really emphasize, because this it seems to me like a direct connection, both in her work, as you already touched on, she through her practice in psychiatry, she used that. She used her skill as a physician even then to help Black people. And it seemed like so much of what drove her doing the Kress-Welsing Institute, as you said, for 3 decades, and all of the talks that she did and people that she helped, it seemed like so much of that was driven by her just profound love and concern for Black people. And it, to me at least, it seems like that's something that also was very much instilled through your parents and grandparents. Can you speak to that?
Well, I would say that I know you mentioned earlier about Frances talking about reading, and certainly in our family, well, let me put it this way. Frances, in her house, there are books, 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 books. And in all of our houses, my sister's in Chicago, who's my aunt, well, I have been back in Chicago for many years now, 20 years. But we all have books. Now, you know, I don't see that as unusual in our family, because that was one of the things. My father was a great reader. Besides him being a physician, he was really a very brilliant man. And he read, and my mother read, so we all read, and you know, but it was not something that was considered unusual. It was what you did, and so when Frances has talked to you know about reading and studying, I mean, this is something that we must do. We must understand who we are. We must understand where we are, and we must understand what America is and what it means in our lives. And you cannot get that off of the television. You just cannot do it. Now, I have not had television. Whenever that was, that television changed from from HD to whatever that was, I had an old television, and this was in Chicago. And so I bought those parts that, you know, were supposed to make it, you know, change from whatever to whatever. Well, it didn't work for me. So, excuse me. So what I decided was that was the creator saying something to me about watching too much television, because I used to love to watch a number of years ago when CBS had a whole series of dramas at night. I would just watch those. You know, something said, no, you're supposed to be doing something other than watching television. So I have not had a television in my home for some time that worked. And the difference that it has made in my life, because I read. I just read more. And once I started looking at television again, I was shocked at the very low level of entertainment, and also the fact that I'm constantly not seeing African Americans in positive positions, in a positive way. And I don't think that we often understand the impact of television on our lives. So that when we are told this white man is the sexiest man in the world, or this young white woman is the most beautiful white woman in the world. They don't say white, most beautiful woman in the world. And we look at her, what does the brain do as far as what we're concerned? So if this is the most beautiful woman in the world and she doesn't look like me, then what does that mean to me? And what is my brain telling me if this wonderful person I'm being told with this straight hair, if this is the greatest hair in the world, then what does it mean about my kinky hair? So I'm not sure that we really understand what means to us and the impact and the impinge of us on media.
Amen. I know that's something Dr. Wellesden talked about a lot. You can go back in the archives and just hear her break down some of the things that she saw happening, both with televisions getting larger and larger and larger, mm-hmm. and with those small screens, people having it on their phone and everything so they can see the videos and seeing, and content now. And her saying that, that the impact of that kind of shrinking your vision, both literally and physically, in terms of what you're paying attention to and just the scope of your horizon. One of the things that you touched on in terms of how it impacts our Black self-respect and what we think about ourselves, where you're constantly being bombarded with these images that are saying beauty is white. White people are beautiful. White people are the most beautiful people ever. And I don't look like that. I'm, you know, dark complexion. I have melanin. My hair is not straight. We mm-hmm. talked just about, I think, 2 weeks ago, we had a different author on, Pam. She was talking about just the power and the importance of whenever you see images, if you see pictures of Dr. Wellesden from the 2000s, the 90s, the 70s, you see her with her natural hair and just looking regal and radiant and giving all this powerful information, giving her theories with such confidence, such poise, and just being the genius that she was. And we talked about just how powerful that is, particularly for Black females, to see her doing this with natural hair. Can you talk about that transition, even your transition to natural hair?
Right. Well, in our family, I was the first person to go natural. And it took me 7 years, from 1957 to 1964, to go through that change. And it was a result of having a discussion on a Sunday with a person in our church, now, who was criticizing Margaret Burroughs. Now, Margaret Burroughs, some people may know, she is the founder of the DuSable Museum in Chicago, Illinois. And this was one of the early Black museums. And Margaret started this in her home. She was an artist and taught art, and she was a very good friend of my mother's. We went to a, we grew up in a Baptist church, in one of the oldest Baptist churches in Chicago, where our grandfather on my mother's side was the chairman of the board of trustees and the deacon board for more than 50 years. Now, on our father's side, they were Methodists, and they were, my father's family were members of the oldest Methodist, Black Methodist church in Chicago. So we were christened in the Methodist church and baptized in the Baptist church. So all sides of the family were satisfied. But we lived closest to the Baptist church, so that's where we went to church and grew up. But my mother, when I think about it, you know, your parent is your parent, and you don't necessarily, and they do what they do, and you're not sitting by analyzing, well, how profound or anything like that. But I think it was because our mother left the Baptist church in the 40s and became a founder, among, with some other people, of a Unitarian fellowship, which was, you know, like that's a, if anybody knows about Unitarianism, that's about they almost have to beg the Christian denomination to say that they're Christians. But so that church attracted many people who were, I would say, free thinkers, people who were actively involved in the Black community, who were pushing for change. And we're talking about in the 50s. This is, well, in the 40s is when my mother left the church and left the Baptist church. And then we left in the 50s, early 50s. Well, Margaret Burroughs, this is just a little background. Margaret Burroughs was one of those members of that church. And Margaret was, I had been, if not a communist, a well, I guess you would call her a fellow traveler. Her husband had lived in Russia, Charlie Burroughs, as a young person. And so she was a radical thinker. She was an artist, a wonderful artist, a poet. And as I said, she started the DuSable Museum in her home. It is now a substantive, significant institution in Chicago. But at the time, you know, she was just putting her work and other maybe statues and things in her home. Well, Margaret was the first person that I ever saw with a natural, and this was back in 1957. And she did not style her hair, but she was just not straightening her hair. And at the time, it did not look great. I mean, because she was just washing it and go. This is well before all what we know about naturals now and how we treat our hair and how we, you know, care for it. There were no hair products for natural hair back in the 50s and no styles. So at our church, this friend of mine said, oh, Margaret ought to be ashamed of herself wearing her hair like that and looking like that. And so we began to have a discussion about hair, and it became very heated because I'm somewhat emotional. And I ended up saying to her, I said, you know, there's something wrong with us thinking that our hair is bad. It's something wrong with us when we think that there's something wrong with our hair. And I said to her, I said, I probably would never have the courage to do that, but I wish that I would. And so, you know, it was rather heated discussion. So once I said that, I was somehow compelled to begin to try to understand what it was with this hair. And at that time, there were not the kinds of books available for black people that there are now. I mean, there was almost nothing available by African Americans to read, and, you know, of people thinking about who we are. And there's books by whites, but hardly anything available by white people. But I started reading and finding and looking for books to read. And it took me literally 7 years, from 1957 to 1964, to get to the place that I could stop straightening my hair. And still in Chicago at that time, I don't know of anyone else who was wearing what we now call naturals. But I will tell you that there was the 12th of April, 1964, that I knew that I could stop straightening my hair. And it was really like what people call an epiphany. I cried and cried and cried and cried and cried. It was a release, you know, like a beginning to come to myself and or a part of myself. And I had already decided prior to that, well, I did a number of things. Once, you know, it's like once you make a step, many things happen for you. You don't put them all together. But Frances came to Chicago she finished med school, I think it was 62. And she came to Chicago and did her internship at Cook County Hospital. And this was at the time of the Freedom Rides. So she was at Cook County where, you know, and doing her internship. So she was housed at the hospital. But she would have many evenings off and things like that, and she would call me. And at this time, this is when the Freedom Rides were going. And I decided, so we would talk every night about what was happening with black people and these freedom rides and what was going on. And we talked for a year, literally for a year, from the time that she came to Chicago to the time that she left. And once she left, I decided that I wasn't going to talk anymore, that nothing else was going to happen in Chicago or in America that had to do with black people that I was not going to be involved in. So right around the same time was the March on Washington, and they were beginning to organize for the March on Washington. And so I ended up being a volunteer and working on the committee for the March on Washington. And through that experience, I met people who were in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was an organization some people know that was operating in Mississippi primarily, but then other southern states, and organizing and working with people to get them to be able to vote. And so they had announced a Mississippi Summer Project where they were inviting students to come to Mississippi for the summer and work with them. Bob Moses was one of the major people in who conceptualized that particular project. And so I'm going through these growing changes, you know. I'm deciding that I can stop straightening my hair, but that didn't just come, you know, like for a moment. That didn't just happen for a minute. It was a process of that I went through. And at the same time, I helped to organize. I was one of the major organizers in Chicago for the March on Washington. And then I decided I would go south in that summer. And so all of these different mind changes, growing mind changes, were affecting me in my way, but also I'm sure and I know they were affecting Frances also. It was like you grow. It's like almost like, you know, there's a saying, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. And the teacher can be, doesn't have to be an individual. It can be a situation. But it opens, you open up to it once you begin to change your mind. So these opportunities happen for me. I start, I'm in Chicago. I lived a totally different life than I live now. And I was wearing high heel shoes and, you know, straightened hair and, I was a different big hat, and I was modeling and things like that. It was a different life. But so I decided that I would not, and I was getting my hair straightened less, and I was getting relaxers, but less. And people said, "What is wrong with your hair? What is wrong? You know?" And so I decided that I would not begin to stop straightening my hair until I got to Mississippi, because many of the women in the movement had already, in their own way, gone through those changes and were wearing naturals. So that's when I got to Mississippi. Not very long after I was there, I stopped straightening my hair. So that was the summer of 1964, and I have not had my hair straightened since. Well, my sisters began to follow me. I'm not sure when Frances stopped straightening her hair, but I remember our mother was not pleased with any of this. You know, she did not say. And she was saying, "Lauren, what have you done to your hair? And Frances, what is wrong with your hair? And, you know, you girls and your hair." And, I mean, this was, you know, 60s, early 60s. Late 50s, early 60s, actually. And then our sister Barbara who I might tell you, who is very ill now, but who was married to Robert Lawrence, who was the first black astronaut, began to stop straightening her hair at some point. They were stationed at Edwards Air Force Base, and my brother-in-law was in the astronaut program. And I remember seeing pictures of Barbara with just, you know, straightened hair and stuff. But at some point, I don't know, remember exactly when, she also, you know, put down the straightening comb or the relaxer. And so I would say since, I don't know when, I don't really remember exactly when Frances went natural, but I led the gang, I would say that.
Wow, context of white supremacy. Again, our guest, Miss Lauren Cress Love. So many aspects of what you just shared are fascinating for so many different reasons. Just number one, to have verification that Dr. Welsing did at one point have straightened hair, because in my brain computer, I can't even conceptualize what that would look like, just because I've never seen her with anything other than natural. That's what she's supposed to look like. Like, yes, Dr.
Right.
Wells.
Well, some people, there are some pictures around of her in her early days, you know, when she was younger. There are actually some on a program, I think, that one of the programs, there are a series of pictures of her, you know, in her younger days. I mean, you know, like, we're 80 and 81, and so we went through we were born 34 and 35, 1934, 1935, and so we were victims, if you would say, of all of that experience. Not the slave experience as such, but, you know, that's the 30s was not many, many years after slavery. You know, when we were born into the Depression. And so our parents, you know, my mom was born in 1906, and my father in 1904, I think. So we're products. So we have grandparents who were in slavery. So our journey, and like many, many other African Americans, our journey has been through time, through periods. And some people unfortunately, do not grow very much. We were fortunate enough to have parents who made it possible for us to grow. But I will tell you that in that process, when we were coming through, the concept among black people or African, we were Negroes then. The idea was that white people infused was that, well, yes, we're going to, you know, because there was deep segregation. We grew up in segregated societies, even the North and even worse in the South. But the promise was from white people, well, yes, but we're going to almost set you free. But you're not ready. You're not ready yet. And so my generation, many people in my generation, were in the process, through their parents, through their teachers, of getting you ready, making you ready. And that was what I think, although I've not had that discussion, but I do think that was many African American teachers felt that their responsibility was to get these little Negro children ready for acceptance in the white world. So we were in my family, we were introduced to ballet and to the symphony and to piano lessons and to theater and things like that through our parents and mostly through our mother, because she was getting us ready. And so I tell people that I knew Bach and Beethoven before I knew Boogie and Blues, and that's true. There was this idea that we were not good enough, and so we had to get better in order to be accepted by white America. And so we went through that phase of, quote, getting ready, you know, which you can never get ready, you know, according to white people and their standards. But so we had to work to get unready at a certain point in our lives. We had to understand what was this lie that had been imposed on us. And so I'm certain that Frances's early, some of her early experiences, she went to Antioch College in Yellow Spring, Ohio, which was an experimental school in a certain kind of way, because early on when, you know, students did four months of class and academics, and then they 4 months of work study where they had different jobs in different places. And she was one of, in her class or division, I think there were only one or two African Americans. Actually, Coretta Scott King went to that same college. And Frances used to say that, you know, since white people think all black people know each other, and I think Coretta was ahead of Frances, and they called her Corey. And so Frances would say that, you know, white people, well, do you know Corey? Do you know Corey? And Frances said she hardly ever knew her. She never saw her because they were different divisions. But, you know, they shorten our names also, you know. So, but we, in the process of our journey, we went through, and maybe not in the same way, but we went through a period, a time where we were introduced to certain aspects of white America. But we also, at the same time, were being impinged upon by the news that came into our home every week through the Chicago Defender of who had been lynched and some person in the South being lynched. And in Chicago, Ida B. Wells, who was known for her advocacy and her fight against lynching and her advocacy on behalf of African Americans, and her daughter was a good friend of my mother's, and her grandchildren, we all went to school together. So there were, in Chicago, you know, Chicago sent the first African-American to Congress after Reconstruction, Oscar Dupuis. It was Chicago has been a highly political city. And so I would have to say that we were influenced by all of these things in our surroundings.
Wow.
It's hard to say how you're impinged. I remember my father was in the Army and in the Second World War, and my mother wrote to the Army. She had her own campaign to get him promoted to a captaincy, and he finally was, but much of it had to do with my mother insisting that he be promoted from a first lieutenant to a captain. And I remember one time in Chicago, they used to have, this is during the Second World War, they used to have these war shows, and they had them in different cities, and they would have all this armament and all on the lakefront, and we lived not very far from Lake Michigan, walking distance actually, when we were growing up. And all along the lakefront of Lake Michigan in Chicago, it would be like an army camp or even more than that, because they had all of these various kinds of armament and tanks and soldiers, mostly white, and it was to boost the war effort. The war effort, that's what they called it. And they had these amphibians. They were called ducks. These were these mobile units that could become land vehicles. Could transform from a water vehicle to a land vehicle. Them to bring troops off of these ships and onto the land. So, and they were called ducks. And we were little girls, and my mother took us to this army show. It's a vast thing, vast, vast. And you could, they would let you ride. You could get a ride on one of these things if you could show that you had bought bonds, which they sold and during the war, where people bought bonds, and war bonds, they were called war bonds. And you paid for them, and then the money would go towards the war effort. Well, we had all kind of bonds and defense stamps and stuff, and they sold them at the schools. And so my mother wanted us to have a ride on this unit, and they would not let us on. And it was just because we were black. They would not let us on. And I can still experience, if I think about it, I can experience the pain of that rejection. And my mother really, insisting that these white men let us on the damn duck. And, you know, they wouldn't. And so this is early, early experiences of racism, because you lived in a black community, you were very much protected. And many people say, well, I never had any experiences of racism. Well, no, because you lived in a black community. You went to a black school. You went to the black grocery store. So if you couldn't get out of your community, you never had those experiences and you didn't recognize them when you had them. But back in the day, these were some of our early experiences. And then I would tell you that when Frances did her residency in here in Washington, D.C., in psychiatry, one of the things that they were taught, that the reason that black people did not like themselves was because their skin color was the color of feces. Now, that was taught in a class in the residency. Now, and Frances and one other African-American woman were the only blacks in that class, and everybody else was white. So can you imagine what white people were thinking? Would you want to touch a person whose skin was the color of feces? So I'm certain that she had many other experiences that were a part of leading her to infusing her thinking, which helped her along the way of, developing some of the concepts that she has developed.
Context of white supremacy. Wow. Mm-hmm. And process, just for listeners, extremely important process, very important concept to keep that in mind. Can you talk about your experience working in SNCC in the 1960s, and particularly if you can share the anecdote or just how the white people who also came down to participate in some of these projects in Mississippi, how you what you observed with them and what you thought about their presence?
Well, the first thing I would have to say about my joining, getting involved in the civil rights movement was, as I said, when Frances was doing her internship and we were, and the Freedom Rides were going on, and we were constantly, you know, every night talking about what was happening with the Freedom Rides and other things. And then Frances left, you know, came back to D.C. And so I didn't have, number one, I didn't have another person to really converse with, because people were not really, really, really at that point. You know, we didn't have, let's say the major organization that we knew about was the NAACP. And we didn't really know about CORE, and CORE was the Congress of Racial Equality, which was one of the major organizations that started the Freedom Rides under James Farmer. But maybe you know, maybe you don't know, that, you know, those buses were burned, people were beaten. It was not just a little ride to the South. It was terror. I would say terror. And I don't think people really know what that kind of terror is. And I think that young people who are, you know, a part of the movement, the current movement, really, really understand what their predecessors who went into the South, what they experienced, because that had never happened before. You know, it had never happened. Nothing like that had ever happened in America before. Now, we didn't really think about that, but when, you know, in retrospect, there had never been a group of black people and white people going into Mississippi and confronting the establishment around the right to vote and the right to public access. That had not happened. That was... that was so significant that, and I mean, at the time, I'm sure that we did not see it as that, but it was. And when you look back and recognize and know that people were killed, beaten, that every step you took was a step of whether you didn't know whether you would survive or not, so that I would have to say that we were heroes. Now, this is the first time I've ever said that. This is the first time I've ever said that. But it was a heroic opportunity or action. And I would say that people who went in 60, Bob Moses went to Mississippi around 61 or 62, and just started organizing, just started talking to people about voting and about rights. It's hard to know now what that was like, because you really were going up against America as it has been conceptualized. I mean, really, you know, it's a racist society. And this was like in the real depths and pits of racism, white supremacy. Churches were burned, houses were bombed. You never knew what would happen to you on any given day when you, as a civil rights worker, stepped out. And you did not think about it. I mean, you didn't think about it. But that is what happened. And I remember I spent 3 years in Mississippi. I went for the summer of 64. But once I was there, I realized and started working with people, I realized, well, I didn't have a right to just come down for a little vacation and start working with people, and then you can just up and leave, and what was that? So I ended up staying 3 years. But when I finally went back to Chicago, I had what is now called post-traumatic stress syndrome. At the time, of course, we were not using that term, but I couldn't move for months. I would get up in the morning, and then I would just go lay down on the couch. I couldn't move, and I didn't really consciously understand what was happening, but it was like you lived with fear every day, and it wasn't a conscious thing, but that was what it was, because you never knew when you if you were in a car whether you would be stopped or killed, really. You just never knew. And you were constantly followed by the police. It's like I'm speaking in retrospect. You know, I'm speaking in retrospect, looking back. But at the time that you're going through it, you're not really conscious of what you're going through. You're just doing what you do. But then when you step out of that years later and you look back and you realize, and I would say that, you know, I was not a student. I was older than most of the young people who were there who were students. You know, I may have been like 10 years older than they. But, I was working a job. I had a job and my own apartment. But I had made that statement, and it's interesting because, you know, you said, I had said nothing was going to happen again in America that had to do with black people, that I was, and we were still Negroes, but had to do with Negroes that I was not involved in. I was not just going to talk. And I didn't, you make a statement. It's like what people call a posture. It's something you post. And you're not even conscious that that you're doing that, but that you put that there. And then if you look back, you see yourself making moves to address that statement that you made. But it's not like you're conscious of doing it. It's just what you end up doing. But those people who went into Mississippi in the 60s and stayed and worked and lived, that now, so that the state of Mississippi now has more elected black officials than any other state in the union, and that was accomplished by young people, that was who put their fears aside, and stepped into the devil's bathtub, so to speak. And so, young people now who are in the Black Lives Matters struggle need to really understand what went before them and the sacrifices that people made so that they are able to do what they do, because we live in a continuum. Unfortunately, America teaches us in segments, so we don't understand how everything is everything. But the efforts that were done by the people who went before the current generation, they're standing on our shoulders, and we're standing on the shoulders of people who went before us, who stepped out, like Paul Robeson and Marcus Garvey his name is stepping out of my mind now, but Carter G. Woodson, and people who looked at our condition, and the many people, Denmark Vesey, Nat Turner, we are all connected, and we're standing on each other's shoulders, and we need to understand that and appreciate that and not reject each other and say, oh, well, they don't know, or we know more. No, you don't. No, you don't. No, you don't. We're learning, and we're constantly learning with each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Wow. What can you speak to how some of the whites who came down to SNCC, how they were received in doing this work next to black people who were risking their lives?
Well, you know, until we understand how beautiful black is, until we understand that our own black selves are and that we're the mothers and fathers of civilization, and until we really intuit that, you know, so that we're not buying white hair, paying Indians and Asians for white people's hair, other people's hair. You know, one of the biggest industries now in the black community is other people's hair. I mean, how degrading is that? How lack of self-respect is that? And I'm not jumping on people, but I am jumping on people. And I'm saying, black is beautiful. We need to look in the mirror and appreciate our black selves and love our black selves. But that's not to your question about white people coming down to Mississippi. The Mississippi Summer Project that was created and conceptualized by Bob Moses, who was a scholar in New York who went to Mississippi in around 1962 and began to just start organizing and talking to people about voting and recruiting local Mississippians to work, young people to work with him. But the Mississippi, but what was beginning to happen as young people started working and talking about voting and beginning to train people to teach them, you know, how to pass the voting, the test for voters, they were being arrested, they were being harassed, they were being beaten, and you know, it was like they were in this enclosed society in Mississippi where nothing got out. So Bob's idea was that in order to open Mississippi, you had to have white people. You had to have whites who had contacts outside of Mississippi, because we called Mississippi like a cotton curtain. You know, it was curtained in, and so people did not get all of the, you couldn't get the information out as to what was happening to black people. So the idea of the Mississippi Summer Project was created, and young people from around the country, college students, were invited to come down to Mississippi and work in the freedom movement. Well, they were young people of goodwill, people who had at least a forward looking forward-looking concepts. But we're in the 60s. And so they came with their bright ideas, but they also came with their racism. And they were greeted by black people who were so glad to see a white person who was not kicking their butts that they just adored these white people. I mean, they adored these, you know, oh my God. We, you know, well, so we always, after meetings within the community, you know, at a church or whatever, we always sang, "We Shall Overcome." And that was really the banner and the anthem of the civil rights movement. And I remember we were in Macomb, Mississippi, and I had been at a meeting and gathered outside of a church and held hands, and there were whites and black people. And always, or traditionally, during the singing of "We Shall Overcome," there might be people might stop and a minister might offer a prayer. And I remember this minister, you know, just thanking God for all these wonderful white people who have come down here to help us. And I really got incensed, because 50 or more years later, I'm still remembering it, because the white people had not made, well, maybe they made a little sacrifice, but I was a working woman. And, you know, I had given up a job and an apartment, et cetera. These were major sacrifices, and I didn't have a lot of money. But he could not see the sacrifices that the black people were making. He was just thanking God for these wonderful white people who have come down here to help us. Well, I'm not going to criticize. This is not a criticism. But the whites who came to Mississippi at the time had not really dealt enough with their own stuff. They still brought their sense of superiority with them. But they couldn't help it because they just brought themselves out of their white communities with their same attitudes, maybe just somewhat lifted up, but they brought themselves. And so often, as opposed, things that would happen would, they would take over a project or a program, as opposed to helping the black people do something, they would take over because they had more skills. And the black people had not changed their minds very much about who they were, and so that they saw these people in the same way that they, that their grandparents or great-grandparents had seen the masters, only the difference being that these people were treating them kindly. And so they were, oh, my goodness, so wonderful. And then, of course, if you really want to get in and talk about the sex and stuff that black men especially felt excited about, being able to have sex with white women, I mean, that's a whole other story that we could talk about, but we don't have to do that. But so there were many dynamics. So in 1965, Stokely Carmichael uttered the concept of black power, and he suggested that whites began to go back to their own communities and began to organize against racism. And that has never really happened yet, really, really. The whites left because it was time for the projects were slowing down, and it was time for them to leave, and the movement was running out of money. And so Stokely said, you know, go back to your own communities and deal with racism. That has never happened substantively. What happened was that whites went back to their communities and they started the anti-war movement, the women's movement, the ecology movement, the sex movement, everything, every movement that you can look at now had, in all probability, something to do with people coming out of the South and out of the civil rights movement, but it never could get to dealing substantively with racism, white supremacy, because what that would mean, that you have to confront your mother, your father, your cousins, your grandparents, and all those people, they could confront in Mississippi, away from home, but they have not yet been able to substantively confront at home. And so that's why we're still, part of the reason that we're still in the dilemma that we're in. But that's only part of the reason, because African Americans, you know, you cannot free yourself with the master's tools. So we have not totally found the tools that we need to use to free ourselves. And one of the things maybe that we understood, maybe, and maybe some of us later and now have understood, that we did, making a white person let you sit at the lunch counter protesting and marching around making a white person let you drink out of their water fountain. Protesting, making a white person let you sit on their toilet stool. You know, drink a cup of coffee at their counter. That was not freedom. Even making white people let you vote. That is not freedom and was not freedom. It moved, but it moved us maybe a little bit, but we have to free our minds, our own minds, which is the major thing. We have to change ourselves. We have to transform ourselves, understand who we are, love ourselves. White people cannot let us make us do that, have nothing to do with that. That's our own work. And when we do that work substantively, then we will be free. But we have to go back to Africa, if not physically, in our minds and claim Africa. Because either we're from Africa or we're from slavery. Now choose. So this is a mind thing, effort. You know, Romans 12:2 says, be ye transformed by the renewal of your mind. And that's what we have to do. That's our work. And Dr. Welsing has led us to understand that. But the work is an individual work. You can't just read the ISIS paper and get it. You got to change your mind. You have to, that's what we have to do. So, yeah.
Fascinating. Again, context of white supremacy. Joining us live, our guest, Ms. Lauren Cress Love. Appreciate having her on the program. Sister of Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. Before I see if any of the folks have any questions that they would like to ask, couple of things, and I thought it was super important to get some of that background information because you also have invested a tremendous amount of time and your life energy in working against racism, white supremacy, and just to kind of share that with listeners as well. I guess number one, you said you were present. I feel like I've heard Dr. Welsing share so many times where she's talked about when she kind of first bumped into Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. and got introduced to some of his theories. You were present when they met. Is that correct?
Well, yes, I was. I was in town. This is 1967, and I was here in. I had come, you know, back from Mississippi, and but I was in Chicago, and. A friend another person who had been in SNCC, Charlie Cobb, who is now a journalist and a teacher and a person of with all kinds of talents. His father, Charlie's father, was Charles Cobb, the great Charles Cobb of the United Church of Christ, a commission on racial justice. And Charlie had gotten a grant through his father to bring a number of people to D.C. who had been in the movement, who were now doing journalistic kinds of things. And I think his idea was, you know, how could we develop an organization or a program where we would share information, et cetera, et cetera. And there was a party of the Black United Front in the area, someplace in the area. And Frances and I went to this, there was a meeting of the Black United Front. And Stokely was there, and Chuck Stone, and I think Cortland Cobb, and other people who had been in SNCC and who were now in the D.C. area, because I don't know if you know this, but many people, once they left Mississippi, a large number of African Americans who were in SNCC came to D.C. For one thing, many of them had been at Howard as students, and so they came back to D.C. And so that's how, this is just an aside, but that's how, you know, Marion Barry, because Marion was chairman of SNCC at one point, but he was not originally from D.C., but a large number of people came to D.C. So, I forgot. What was your question?
You were part of this party where they, I guess, brought some of
the
Mr.
Neely,
Fuller.
Neely, mm-hmm. Neely Fuller. So there was this party, and following that meeting, and Francis and I went to the party, and people were sitting around talking, and this brother was standing. I still see him standing. He was standing up by the door, kind of by the door. And I don't even remember what the discussion was, but at some point he kind of stepped forward, but he didn't move. I mean, it wasn't like stepped into the middle of the group or anything like that. He just kind of started talking about the United Independent Compensatory Code for Victims of White Supremacy. And he had this suitcase with him, and in it is what is now called the code. And he started talking about these ideas that he had about racism, white supremacy. And we had never heard anything like this before. As a result of that information, on that discussion, Francis arranged to meet him after at another time. And so that was the beginning of her relationship with Neely Fuller. That was the beginning of her studying with Neely, which ultimately helped her to develop her own theories on racism, white supremacy, which much of Neely's work is at the basis of that. What then happened, as a psychiatrist, Francis asked the question, well, if there is this racism, white supremacy, as a psychiatrist, my question would be, if a person seems to have a superiority complex, underneath that complex of superiority is an inferiority complex. So she began to ask the question, well, why? What is it about white people that would make them feel inferior to black people? And as a result of that thinking, she began to understand about color. And my father told her to look at the melanocyte, And as those of you who have read the Kress theory the ISIS papers, the melanocyte is that aspect of our beingness that gives us color. Melanin is the output or the excretion is what causes us to have color. And the lack of melanin is albinism, and that's what white people are. They are albinos. They have the inability to produce color. And because color is the lack of color is a recessive trait, the production of color is a dominant trait. So that Francis began to understand that this white supremacy, that the people who are white are really representative of only one-tenth of the world's population. The rest of the world are people of color, either black, brown, yellow, or red. These are because they are able to produce melanin. If you do not hold these people of color at bay one way or another, white people could be annihilated in a generation, or at least two at the most. It's already happening. So that the struggle, racism, white supremacy, is an effort on the part of people who classify themselves as white. It's an effort to protect themselves. And the reason that it's hard for us to really get it is because we have the we're melanated. We're not threatened by being canceled out. So that is the dilemma that we find ourselves in, and that was the beginning of Francis's work with Neely, which went on for a number of years. I mean, continue. They have a up until this moment are joined at the hip, so to speak. Francis then helped to publish Neely's. Neely had 3,000 handwritten pages in this suitcase that he had, and Carl Hutchison, who was a medical student at Howard, who was doing a residency in surgery, was introduced to Neely. Francis introduced Carl to Neely. He became very interested in Neely's work, and he was the one that did the first editing and typing up of these 3,000 handwritten pages. And it took them over 10 years to get the code published, and it's available through Neely Fuller, but it's connected. There's a straight line from Neely to Francis, or back and forth. It's connected to, and it was the beginning of Francis's additional thinking on racism, white supremacy, and her first book, her first publication, The Press Theory on Color Confrontation, which got her fired from Howard, or at least not given tenure at Howard Medical School, was a result of, or her publication of The Press Theory had to do with her not being able to get tenure at Howard Medical School.
Mm-hmm. She talked about that on the program. We went back, and she's been a guest on the broadcast 31 times, her third visit, where she shared with us back in 2010 that she had, some years later, she had got information that there was some involvement from the federal government in having her be denied tenure at Howard University. It had been a while since I'd even heard that program, but that's in the archives, February 2010, where she shared that with us. Mm-hmm. Before I nab a quick question from any of our listeners, certainly the situation with the housing, she talked about that on this broadcast and many other mm-hmm. programs. The Final Call, they did an excellent report. This was a couple years ago. And just mm-hmm. talking about the constant strain and it, even connecting it with, because she did this as well, the mm-hmm. Noise pollution from this daycare center that was next to her property. This was a part of the effort to get black people out of Washington, D.C., and she talked about that constantly. I'm sure this is something that she brought up with you all. Just if you can speak to that and any efforts on the part of the family to try to retain this property.
Well, I can't talk about what's going to happen with this house, but I can say that what was happening with Francis as far as this house is concerned is what's happening with black people all over this country. We're being forced out of urban centers. And so Francis lives in, her home is located on 16th Street in Washington, D.C. And she was in the middle of three houses. They were not attached, but three houses. And then there is a school. And when she purchased her house, the school was, I'm not sure that it was owned by the District of Columbia. I tend to believe that this school may have been owned by Jewish people back in the 50s. Before the city, when the city was still predominantly white. See, what happened in D.C. was that after Brown versus Board of Education, and this happened in not just the District of Columbia, but many cities around this country, that after Brown versus Board of Education, white people moved out of the city, moved to the suburbs, because they did not want their children going to school with African-American children. And so in many situations, they sold their houses. But in the District of Columbia, they did not sell their houses for the most part. They rented them. So that in the 1970 census, the District of Columbia was 70% black, but it was also 70% rented housing, which means that for all intents and purposes, black people did not own anything. Now, black people did, but in terms of the numbers of blacks who owned their own homes compared to the number of blacks who were living in the district, the numbers who were rented far outnumbered those who owned their own homes. So that what has begun to happen, what has started happening, and, but this has been going on now for maybe 20, 25 years now, is that whites began to reclaim their homes. And so I don't know whether the Jewish day school, community day school, was owned by Jewish people originally, but I tend to think that maybe it was and that they rented it to the district. And so for a number of years, it was a school for children with problems, but that the city didn't really own it. I don't know that specifically. But all I know is that at whatever point, these people began to reclaim or take over the school. These three houses that were just south of them on the same street and right next, they began to decide that they wanted to have them. And so they bought the house next to them. Francis's house was in the middle. And then they bought the house on the other side of Francis, which was owned by a black psychologist, Fred Phillips, who never, ever said anything to Francis about him having sold his house to these people. He never said a word and sneaked out, I'm saying it publicly, moved out in the dead of night practically without saying, I've sold my house to these people, which put Francis in total jeopardy. So that she's that on both sides of her are properties that are now owned by the Jewish community day school, and I mean, you know, people. I don't know that people really understand. Folks want to take your house, put you out of your house, and I have a right to do that. Because you don't count at all. And, I mean, imagine what that would do to you. You got to move. You got to go. That's just like what happened to the Indians. You got to go. We don't give a damn who you are, what you say. You got to go. And that's the position that she is was put in and has been put in. So, well, anyway, that's what was going on. And that's the pressure. The other part of it is that when she first started complaining, because Frances had a very high sensitivity to noise, and the playground, these people put this playground next door to her. And since I have been in her house, I understand the noise, although I am not as affected by it as she was, but this was not new. Because before this last piece about the school happened, the street that she lives on was widened. 16th Street was widened. And the noise from the traffic was very annoying to her. And so she had a big struggle with the District of Columbia and the transportation people and whatever, and streets and sand, I guess, about the noise when they widened 16th Street. And so she protested so much that they put a strip down, a medium strip down the center of 16th Street from, I think, where her house is to maybe, I don't know how far up, where they planted some bushes and stuff, and this was supposed to somehow lessen the noise, the traffic noise. So she had been in this struggle with people for some time. I mean, it wasn't, you know, the She Shall Not Be Moved movement was something new, but she'd been struggling about her home and traffic noise and noise for a number of years.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I know definitely Mr. Fuller brought that up as well, and just the strain, I guess. I'll pause there so that folks can dial in, but I definitely would encourage folks to keep that in mind, just the stress of talking about racism and then the place where you rest your head, your residence, to just think having a fight and battle about that, and then the noise, particularly if you're very sensitive. I know I'm not a fan of having a lot of noise in the house either, but just that can really take a toll, can impact your health even. And I think Mr. Fuller had said that medical officials, her doctors had told her that just having to deal with that stress and the noise and everything, that it could impact her health.
Right.
I think that's definitely important. People should keep that in mind. See if we can nab some of the folks who dialed in, if they have a quick question that they would like to ask. If people could just be efficient, get right to your question, see if we can get as many folks as we can. Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Dr. Welsing's sister, Ms. Lauren Cress Love?
Yes, I do. Good evening, Dusty. Good evening to you, Mrs. Love.
Hi.
I just want to say that your sister was a treasure, and I hear her name being mentioned more today, her theories being quoted more today than when she was alive, so she will live forever. I had two questions for you.
Mm-hmm.
The first one was regarding the ISIS papers.
Uh-huh.
Dr. Welsing came on this show and she expressed that her sentiment that she felt that the terrorist organization named ISIS and them having a publication also called the ISIS Papers.
Yes.
And she said that the ISIS flag resembled the artwork on her first book.
Yes.
And she felt like it was, she even wrote, I believe she said she wrote President Obama expressing how she felt like this was an attack on her.
Yeah.
We did a tribute show for Dr. Welsing, and a gentleman called in, and he said he was arrested, and he had the ISIS papers in his book bag or on his possession. And when he went to pick up his possessions after they released him, the ISIS papers wasn't there. He went back to get it, and he said that the FBI or Homeland Security actually came to his house to speak to him, because he had a copy of the ISIS papers. So I just want to know, do you think that the stress from that also contributed to her death? And can you speak on, if you know anything about that situation? Thank you.
That specific situation I don't know about, but I do believe that that calling this so-called terrorist organization ISIS, and then publishing something called the ISIS papers that's related to terrorism was a deliberate act. Yes, I do believe that. And, you know, Francis has been on somebody's list for years, you know, on federal government's list for years. Just as it was just stated that that pressure was put on Howard University when she first wrote her the Cress theory, and to not give her tenure, and because the person who was the head of the medical school at the time was also the highest ranking officer in the National Guard, and he ultimately was quoted as saying that Francis's work embarrassed him among his white friends. And You know, Francis, well, you maybe don't know, but Francis constantly called the president's hotline. Constantly. Barack Obama probably went, I don't want to say this, I won't even say this, but I'm sure he gave a sigh of relief when he stopped getting calls from her because she calls his hotline frequently and did send him a copy of the ISIS papers in a nice bound. She said, I didn't see the book, the cover that it was bound in, but she said very nice, you know, nicely packaged. But so, of course, you know, we need to understand where we are. Of course, that has something to do with it. Yes, yes. You know, I mean, if we think back of all the leaders, people who have stepped forward on our behalf, what has happened to them? In 1983, when they had the 20th anniversary of the March on Washington, there were hardly any of the people who were there on that platform at the Lincoln Memorial. Many of them had since died in 20 years, something, or had been otherwise afflicted so that they were not able to do the substantive work that they had done in the past. So, you know, it's like where we are. Yes, yes. Does that answer your question, sir? Hello?
Thomas in New York.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. Yes, it did. It answered my question. And my last question for you very briefly. Do you think that now that you so eloquently stated the what was going on with her living situation in the Jewish center, are your plans now to sell that house to that Jewish center, or are you going to try to keep it out of their hands?
That's my last question.
Thank you for coming on the show.
I'm not able to answer that question at this point.
Appreciate that, Thomas in New York. Our caller, retired firefighter in Florida, did you have a question for Ms. Love? You should be with us.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I just have to say I can hear your sister in your speech and in your talk, and I would like to also praise your parents for opening the door to what I'm hearing today. It's truly is a family affair as far as what I'm hearing from you, man. We really appreciate you coming on the program. My question is, we oftentimes on this program get to ask questions and talk to white people who are claiming that they are counter-racist. You briefly alluded to some of the same things that was going on back during the 1960s. Would it be troubling to ask you to elaborate on that more, on how there was a lot of white people who were wanting to join in with black people, but yet they weren't serious? Is there any way you can elaborate on that?
Well, I would not say that they weren't serious, but I don't know if you heard my discussion earlier about what it took for me to stop straightening my hair. In other words, you just don't get up and go to Mississippi and you know, that means that you don't bring your history and your culture with you. You may have stepped away to some extent and said, yeah, but just as we are, as a people, are not yet totally free, because the freedom is a state of mind. It was not, and that's what I think that part of what we didn't at the time totally understand in the civil rights movement. And I'm not sure that it's understood now in the Black Lives Matter movement, that protest is okay, but what has to happen with us in order to be free is we must free our minds. We have to, it's almost like we have to take a scalpel and go on the inside of our mind and scrape away all the negativity that we have ingested as a result of being black in America. You know, it's, so, say for instance, like in Africa, I understand that two of the best-selling products are skin lightener and wigs. Now, you know, and certainly in America, those are two products that are highly profitable. And we're giving money to other groups of people for their hair. I mean, you know, so we have to free our minds. And that is work. And Dr. Welsing led us up to understand where we are. But now, what is it that we do in order to totally free and to stand tall and straight and love ourselves and respect ourselves? So, I don't know if that's responding to your question or not.
Well, I mean, I love from what I'm hearing right now, and I can just sit at your feet and hear you all day and all night long with the information that is coming from you. And so I really appreciate what I'm hearing. I mean, it's just wow. It just made my day, really, because I'm still upset over the idea of your sister not being here also to be able to articulate. But having you here is oh man, it's just
well.
Let me
say this. I thank you so much. But let me say this. Nobody lives forever, and
yes, ma'am.
You know, no, Francis wasn't going to be here no 200 or 300 years. You know,
that's right.
He wasn't.
Yes,
she
yes,
just
ma'am.
Wasn't. Neither you or I. She brought a message to us. And I've been thinking recently that Jesus became more popular after his death than when he was walking around with a little band of 12. So, you know, just as people, I mean, Francis's name has been out there all over the nation since she transitioned. And so more people are talking about the ISIS papers, are talking about her theories than before. So maybe that's what had to happen in a way, you know, so that people would start hearing what this great woman was saying. And, you know, we got to get beyond what she was saying. In other words, you know what I'm saying? You know, so she comes to town and she talks, we get filled up, oh, we're so glad. Then we, you know, go home, and what do? We don't do anything. We
That's
just
true.
Wait till she comes back again. You know, when is she coming? You know, you know, we have to get to work, brothers and sisters, and others. We have to get to work if we're going to save ourselves and this country. I mean, this is real serious work. So we have to step beyond just even looking in the book. Francis had to, if you're in the book, Francis had the 10 stops, which she then, you know, moved to 17, I think, by this point. If we just each took one stop and said, well, for the next 4 months, I'm going to work on this stop with myself, that means I am going to stop with whatever, cursing, or I'm going to stop gossiping, or I'm going to stop throwing trash, or I'm going to pick up the trash in my neighborhood, or the other stops there in the book. If we just did that, what a difference it would make in our community. You know, if we just stop talking about each other, you know, in a negative way, if we just start trying to love ourselves, which is why the trash is in the street, why the children are killing each other, and all the other negative things that are going, because we haven't gotten over the horror of the kidnap and the abuse of the plantation. That stuff is still sitting on us. It gets passed down parent to child. We don't read because you could be destroyed for trying to read on the plantation. We don't understand the connection. There's a direct connection between us not wanting to read and the punishment that you received. A friend of mine, Dr. Harold Pates, who was president of one of the colleges here, told me that his aunt, who had been enslaved, and she was elderly, and their father used to send them to her to, you know, help her in different things, and that there was something wrong with both of the fingers, her two fingers, the fingers on both her hands. They were either I don't know exactly the word, but they were crippled, like her fingers. And he later found out that this was something that had been done to her as a child during slavery when she was trying to learn to write. Mm. You know, now we got stories that we don't know or we're not told or were whispered of the horrors of slavery. We haven't even begun to really understand what happened to us during enslavement, plus being kidnapped, you know, that middle passage, the horrors. And that stuff is still sitting on us. We don't understand. You know, like white people are saying, oh, well, that was then. I didn't have nothing to do with that. No, that is then. That is now. We are still suffering from being kidnapped, from losing our parents, from losing our village, from losing our community. It's a continuum. There was never any stopping time from the first African being put on a slave ship to right now. But if you don't understand the connections, if we don't understand the connections, then we don't understand what is sitting on us right now, right at this very minute, all of us, including Francis Welsing. You know that? None of us are totally free. You understand? We're still suffering. So we need to get to work. We need to get out our proverbial brooms and start cleaning out our minds, however we can do it, and start loving, substantively loving ourselves. Francis used to say, well, go look in the mirror and tell that person in the mirror that you love them. And that's kind of hard, but keep looking at them and embracing them, embracing that person in the mirror. And then we can turn around and embrace the people in our family, you know, our children more, our husbands, our wives, our cousins, and the people in our neighborhoods. Substantively embrace them, and then we'll start cleaning up our neighborhoods because we respect ourselves. So, have I answered your question at all?
I appreciate just listening to what you have to say, ma'am. And I'm charged to, once school starts tomorrow, the young black males that I deal with on a daily basis, that I'm going to be even more charged up into my practice of sharing with them just by hearing what you have to say. Really appreciate it, man.
You know, I really do appreciate what you said. I really do. And if you're working with young children and our male children need so much love. They really do. And,
ma'am,
I mean, you know, we have been deliberately, you know, back following the Depression, then when welfare came in, for black people, you know, who were suffering under the Depression, but you could get welfare, but you could not have a man in the home. I don't know if you all know about that, but they set it up. The woman could get welfare, but she couldn't have a husband in the home. And they had social workers who would come into your house and look under your bed and look in your closet to see if there was a man there. Now, that was a public policy. And so we had that policy implemented for seven generations among black people in America. And so that destroyed our families. That was a public policy. That was a racist policy, because a black man carries what the keys to the kingdom, the color. We can't have a colored child unless we have sex with a black man. And it has to be his initiative, not ours. Francis talks about that, you know, that if you try to put a gun on a person and make them have sex, they can't do it. So, you know, I mean, she has talked about that and illustrated that in her discussions. So that is why the black man is so impinged upon, is at every turn. And so we need to have more discussion of that, because we need to understand what it is about our relationships with each other that are so difficult. It's because of all the forces that have been impinged upon us. Say, for instance, once you take the black man out of the home and give the money to the black woman, she is in charge. Male children then see the mother in charge. She's supposed to take care of me, as opposed to me taking care of her. That's, you know, I mean, there's so much dynamics to that. So I'm so glad to hear about, you know, an African-American man working with African-American boys, young people, and, you know, to help them, to give them some love, to help them to develop a sense of self and a belief in self and a belief I am a founder with several other people of a school in Chicago. And one of the things that I say to my children and show them, I tell them to look around a room and pick something out, anything. Then I ask them, what is it that you chose? What is it that you chose? What is it that you chose? And whatever it is they chose, I help them to see that before it was something that they could see, before it was a material manifestation, it was an idea in their minds or in the inventor's mind. So it's the mind that is most important. The material is just a result of a thought. So it's what we think that is the most important thing. So if we begin to think and see ourselves as marvelous, wonderful, beautiful, magnificent, great, then the energy off of those words makes a difference. So anyway, I'm
Thank
on
you,
my
ma'am.
Soapbox. Thank you so much for your question.
For sure. We had, I thought it was one more person that dialed in with a hand up. A couple. The person that dialed in from, I think this is Ross. Did you have a question, Ross?
Yes, greetings to you, Gus, and greetings to you, Mrs. Love. I wanted to say thank you for the work that you've done fighting for the freedom of our people, and I would love to just lift the spirit of Dr. Wilson up at this time. I had two questions for you. The first one was, on a couple of occasions, Dr. Wilson spoke about working on the ISIS papers too, and I wanted to know if you knew anything of that and if there's any potential that it might go into print, or did she even get to finish it before she passed?
Well, I don't know where it is, if she was working on it. I mean, and whether it was manifesting, actually materializing. I know that she was constantly saying that she was going to do that and that people were very anxious. So I don't know. I know that we're going to be trying to figure out, you know, she has many, 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 many tapes from lectures from her institute. And so we'll be trying to see how we can get some of this information and make some of this information available to people. Because I do think that I don't know if wherever it is that you're living, if you all have studied black study groups, But we need some study groups, and we need to, we really do need to start studying, and then not study for this the point purpose of study, but studying for the purpose of using, infusing ourselves so that we act in a different way. You know what I mean? So, that's still in kind of, you know, the real embryonic stages in terms of what we'll do, you know. It's been a difficult time for us, you know, all of us. And, you know, let me extend my sympathy to all of you for the loss of Dr. Wells. And, you know, people say, well, you know, to the family, we're so sorry. But I extend my deepest sympathy to all of those who love my sister and whom she helped in any kind of way. I extend the deepest sympathy to you. And I mean, yes, sincerely.
Thank you so much. And I have one last question for you. Just based on the discussion that you had earlier regarding your upbringing, it seemed like your ancestors, your parents, and your grandparents really worked hard to keep your family cohesive. My family's completely fragmented because of racism and white supremacy. And I just wanted to know, what lessons can we take from your upbringing and your family's experiences to try and create a more cohesive and balanced environment in our families? And thank you so much for taking my call.
Well, what I would say, sweetheart, is that our family was by no means perfect, not by any means. I don't think there are any perfect black families. I don't think there are any perfect families in America, period. And we have, I mean, you know, we have had some of the same problems that other families have. I think maybe we were fortunate. My mother's father came from Canada. Now, he wasn't originally from Canada, but his father's father, I think that's where it was, his father's father, my great-grandfather's father, I think, met a German woman in New York, and they married, and her family threatened to kill them. And so they went to New York, I mean, went to Canada. So I think that, and so my grandfather's, my mother's father, came down to the States in the 1863 or so and joined the Union Army and fought in the Civil War. I think, although I know that there was racism up there, you know, in Canada, but I think that it was maybe not as severe, so that when my mother's father came to the States in 1893, he was a little less oppressed than maybe some people, some African Americans in America who had gone through generations of slavery. And, you know, because he came and he ended up starting businesses and ultimately went into the undertaking business. But he had a music store and different kinds of businesses. And I think that to some extent, maybe, I don't know, you know, but maybe that may have had something to do with the influences, you know. Those influences are very subtle, you know, but maybe. That's all I can say.
Wow. Appreciate those questions, Roz. We had, looks like there are about three other folks. Did you have time to take final three questions, or I know you...
Oh, sure.
Okay. The person that dialed in from a block number, did you have a question for Ms. Love?
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you for taking my call, Gus. And Ms. Love,
Mm-hmm. It's an honor to talk to you.
Okay.
And I wanted to thank you right now for reminding us about the melanocytes. Your father, do you mind telling us his first name?
Yes, my father was Henry Noah Kress, and his father was Henry Clay Kress, and they were both doctors.
I want to say that he was ahead of his time. Like right now, just on the melanocytes, there's a new science called epigenetics, and the melanocytes are located in the epidermis, and that is considered a brain, actually. And it's a new science, and it's very groundbreaking, and it's very important for people to understand. So I just wanted to honor him, honor you, and thank you for reminding us about that. And speaking, and my question is, Dr. Wilson would always tell us that black people don't qualify for mental health. Do you agree with that? And if so...
Wait a minute, say that again. That black people what?
Don't qualify for mental health.
Don't qualify for mental health?
Yes. Dr. Wilson would tell us that. And I was just wondering if you agree with that, and if so, what do you think are the implications of that, and how do we face that that truth? If you agree.
Well, I don't. I'm not sure because I don't know. I haven't heard her say that, which doesn't mean anything. But I'm not sure what she meant by that. What did do? How did you? You know, what did you get from that she was saying?
Well, I don't know, for me, I it's a reminder. I mean, I have it written down so it can remind me every day that when I interact with black people and they do things, you know, do things strange or whatever the case may be, that, you know, you're dealing with a person that, you know, according to Dr. Wilson, which changed, you know, they don't qualify for mental health. And that's helped me in my interactions with black people extremely. And it's, I think it's true. And it just, it's something that once you face it, it definitely changes a lot the way I interact with black people.
If what she was meaning that that above and beyond everybody else's stuff, we have major issues of our own that no other group of people in this country have. But let me give you an example. Everybody else in this country is a person, except the Native Americans or the original people of this country. Everybody else in this country they themselves are the descendants of people who came to this country on a purpose. It doesn't matter what language they speak. They all say the exact same words, in whatever language. Either they say my grandfather, my great-grandfather, my great-great-grandfather, or me, came to this country to make a better life. We're the only group of people here who came from someplace else but did not come here on our own purpose. Now, purpose is critical to existence. If you're going to maximize yourself, you have to have a purpose. But we didn't come here with a purpose. We came here on somebody else's purpose. We didn't, you know, and to come here to come to another country, say, just to move across the street takes thinking. You know, you got to pack up your stuff. You got to find a place, on and on, just to move across the street or to move to another city or another state or another country. All of that takes thinking, and you don't just jump up and do it. You have to think about it. So for people decided to come to this country, even the ones who are creeping across the border right now, they have had to think about that, and they have had to think about why they're doing what they're doing. So they come here prepared, and that's why the Hispanics are outstripping us. They have come here with a purpose. They have sacrificed. They have, you know, faced danger, whatever, to get here. But they have come here for a purpose that was determined before they got here. That was not our case, is not our case. And so we have to define, we have to redefine, why are we here? Now, we must be here for, and the Creator may have had his own reason for us being here, maybe to talk about racism, white supremacy, whatever, but not here on our conscious purpose. So we have to decide why we're here. You know, what do we want to be and do? Maybe we need to get on a boat and go back to Africa and then decide to come back and to make a better life for ourselves, if not literally, figuratively. But that is part of what's going on with us that we haven't understood. That's why we're just kind of wandering around, standing on street corners, drinking and smoking and doing drugs and stuff, feeling depressed and unhappy, because we do not know why we're here, and we're not on our purpose.
Oh, thank you so much. It's, like I said, it's an honor to talk to you. I hope you come back and talk to us again, and take care of yourself as far as health wise.
Well, thank you.
I don't know if you take coconut oil or research that, but if not, you can research that. It's very good for the brain. And
is that right?
Yeah, it's very good. So if you, extra virgin coconut oil, it's good for the, it's very good.
Coconut oil and what else?
Extra virgin coconut oil.
Extra virgin coconut oil.
Yeah, 2 tablespoons okay. a day. It protects the brain. So.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Thank you for everything. Thank you for
and
your family.
You.
And thank you for answering my questions.
Thank you. Thank you.
For sure. Person that called in, last four digits, 4231. 4231. Did you have a question for Lauren Cress Love?
Yes, I do have a question that I would like to ask. And peace to all of the callers, the hosts, and our guests. My question would be, do you think that the Christian population of black people, like in America, would possibly benefit from a conversion to possibly Islam or something like that? Because, you know, I'm noticing a connection between the teachings of Islam and the teachings of the ISIS papers, and let alone the coincidence on the other side of the game that involves the alleged ISIS and the Quran and Islam and things like that. So it's kind of, yeah, that's my question.
Well, I don't know enough about Islam to say that, although I certainly know that the work of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X and the Honorable Louis Farrakhan has as Muslims has been valuable and beneficial to us as a people. I think that Christianity has been misinterpreted and diluted, and the version that's been given to us as African American people has not necessarily been one that has allowed us to free ourselves at this point. I mean, we have in every city, major city, you have churches all up and down the streets, but we still find ourselves in a very bad condition. So that something is wrong, you know, if we're not, and this is not to dismiss or to dismiss anyone, but it is what it is. Now, there are some people who are using Christianity and helping African-American people, but other people are not really using that version. Now, we do know that Jesus was a revolutionary, but we also know that he was killed. And we also know that many of the aspects and books and writings of the early Christians were diluted or suppressed, so that those aspects of Christianity which would help people to be more courageous have been suppressed, you know, so that the people could be controlled. So I can't really totally answer your question, because I have not really given it real, real deep thought. But I do know that at least the works of, however complicated some of this stuff has been, that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X and Louis Farrakhan and others have utilized a religion that is attempting to help us to free ourselves to some extent. I would have to say that.
Okay, appreciate your response.
Mm-hmm. Right on. And I think this is Lady in New York. Did you have a question for Miss Love, Dr. Welsing's sister?
Hello, everyone on the line. Hello,
if you could raise your voice, your volume is a little low. Just speak up for us.
Hello, Miss Love. Hello, everyone on the line.
Hi.
Thank you for being with us today. Actually, my question was previously answered. So I just want to thank you for being with us here on the line today and sharing some of your family history and some pertinent things about your sister. Sorry for your loss. And Gus, I'll go ahead and mute my line, or if there's another, you know, caller on, let them have the floor. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
For sure. I think we got our callers in. I did want to make sure that I got out, because I think you had said that there is a memorial planned for March, the day after Dr. Welsing's birthday, which is, I believe, March 18th, that there's a second memorial. Can you just share some of the details so that people, if they would like to come in and attend and be there to uplift her name, can you give some of the details?
Well, I don't have enough detail. It's going to be the 19th of March. Her birthday is would have been the 18th of March. And it will be at the Metropolitan AME Church on the March 19th at 1 p.m. I don't have all of the details, but I would tell you that if you call me, so I can get your number, then I can get the information and you know, relay it to you, and then you can share it with others.
That is a plan. I will be sure to do that, because I know there are a lot of folks who either are in the area and they would like to attend, or, you know, they would definitely make plans having mm-hmm. some advance notice to be in
right.
attendance for March, sort of March 19th.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Outstanding.
But let me say this. This is something else that I've been thinking about. There have been a number of memorials for Francis, maybe at least 10 that I know of, you know, different parts of the country. But I'm also beginning to think that we need to honor her. We need to really not just read her book, but start really reading and taking ourselves as seriously as you know, life or death. And that is a better way of honoring her than just memorializing. And I think that memorializing is wonderful, but I think that we have to get to work, you know, serious work. We need to look around our communities and understand what's happening to us and come up with some plans and programs so that we can counter the plan to push us out to suburbs where we have no political power, and it'll be like the Bantustans of South Africa and, you know, like Soweto and these other, you know, communities where people were just forced away, because that is what's going on in our country. So we have to, you know, strengthen ourselves, strengthen our resolve, and understand that we're the mothers and fathers of civilization.
Ashe, that I told Miss Love when I spoke with her over the weekend, it's a bit uncanny at times how similar she sounds to Dr. Welsing. You said that even your mom noted that she had a difficult time telling you two apart on the phone. Is that right?
Yeah, that is true. That is true. A lot of times my mother wouldn't know which one of us it was that she was talking to.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Fascinating. It has been just outstanding to get a lot of this information that I guess we just never thought to ask more details, to find out more about you all's grandparents and parents and how that influenced both of you doing so much just outstanding work, having such high levels of Black self-respect and investing so much of your life into trying to help Black people and to work against racism, white supremacy, and the process of continuing to grow along the way as you all did this work. But just really, it has been just an outstanding privilege to hear from you this evening. Again, as I've been reminding folks, Dr. Welsing was talking about your youngest sister. Is it Barbara Kress?
Yeah, Barbara Kress Lawrence, right.
We had been talking about her and also sending our thoughts and prayers to her as well. So we definitely hope that she recuperates and can get her health together. I know mm-hmm. this has been a very difficult year for you, and I am just amazed at your just the memory, so many details and names and information for all the years and service that you've been doing. It is astounding. Can only hope I'm halfway that clear and intelligent, if I can make it that far. But I hope we can have you back on the program. And it has just been outstanding to hear from you this Tuesday evening. Again, our guest, Miss Lauren Kress Love. I will definitely give you a call so that we get the information for the service that's going to be next month.
Right.
Just hope that you continue to take excellent care of yourself.
Well, thank you. And again, I want to thank, you know, the people who have called in and who have inquired or asked questions or and I sincerely mean that I offer everyone, LeVar, you, and everybody, my deepest sympathy, because we lost a giant. And, you know, many people have, you know, people have just cried, you know, when they heard that Francis had transitioned. But also, this is a part of life, and so while we mourn her, the best way to mourn her is for us to get off our butts, read the book, or do something, make a plan, do something to further not just her work, but further our freedom and our development of self-respect and love for ourselves and our people.
Ashe. Ashe. That sounds extremely similar to the way Dr. Welsing frequently, kind of the last remark she would make before we would wrap things up, a call for us to be active. We have enough spectators. It's time for us to get out and do some work and to apply what she taught for those of us who felt like she meant something to our lives and our mm-hmm. understanding of the problems we have as Black people. Again, just we're super grateful for you sharing a bit of your time with us this evening. Hopefully this will not be the last time. We definitely will look forward to having you back on the program to share some more of your thoughts and insight. And just super grateful, and we will definitely be in touch. Again, Miss Lorne Cress Welsing, thank you, and enjoy the rest of your Tuesday.
Lorne Cress Love.
Sorry, got me. Lorne Cress Love. My apologies.
That's okay. Thank you so much for inviting me to share.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We will be in touch. You enjoy the rest of your Tuesday evening.
Thank you. Sure. Goodbye to everyone.
Good evening.
Mm-hmm. Good evening.
Context of white supremacy. Wow. Great to have her on the program. I can give my gratitude again. One of our listeners, I believe in the Chicago area, was able to attend the service that they had for Dr. Welsing. I think it was in the last 10 days. I was able to attend and said, hey, you should definitely reach out and get in contact with her. It was even more, to try to get the correct word, it was even more... I'm even struggling to come up with the correct way to categorize it, but she sounds a lot like Dr. Welsing. Like, they have a lot of the same mannerisms. Certainly they have a lot of the same opinions on racism, even though they weren't doing exactly the same thing. They both spent, you know, a good 50 years working against racism and doing various projects, and her opening up a school. It's incredible, but she is at Dr. Welsing's residence right now. So I was told to give her a call, and I didn't, you know, I saw it was a DC area code. I was like, oh, okay. So I wrote it down and I went to dial the number, and it popped up on my screen as Dr. Welsing. So I was all, you know, kind of shook at first. So I hung up, was like, wait a minute. And then I thought, I was like, oh, okay, she's at Dr. Welsing's house. So it was quite an experience to be talking to her the way she sounds like Dr. Welsing, and then she's at Dr. Welsing's house, so her number it has her name popping up for the number. Man, I'm just glad we were able to get her on the program. I thought it would be great for folks to be able to hear from her and to get some of the background information. I feel a bit ashamed. So I failed as a host to ask Dr. Welsing some of those questions directly when she was here. I felt like it was all much, you know, always so much to ask and to get her thoughts about this and that and all of that. But I mean, wow, just it would have been a shame to miss out on all of the information about their family and their parents and grandparents. Her grandfather, Henry Clay Cress, and father, Henry Noah Cress, to get some of that information about all of them and what they did. Her sister, Barbara Cress Lawrence, and marrying Robert Lawrence, first Black astronaut. I mean, it's pretty astounding, all of the different, you know, things that went into producing Dr. Welsing and her sisters. We just heard from Lauren Cress Love. Like, wow. At any rate, if anything, again, if Dr. Welsing, her work meant something to folks who listened to this program, people who heard her and the numerous times that she was on the broadcast over the years, I would definitely encourage that should be reflected in a lot of Black self-respect. I cannot say that enough times. Dr. Welsing certainly commented on many things over the years that she heard from her sister. Just always taking notes, always paying attention to things, checking the newspaper, being informed about what was happening in the world and how that applied to her theory of racism and white genetic annihilation. But man, the thing that she talked about, at least to me, one of the things that she seemed to talk about most was black self-respect in the way that we carry ourselves, the way that we treat other black people, having patience with other black people, recognizing that black people, we do not qualify for mental health as a result of the system of white supremacy. Just keeping that in mind in the way that we deal with and treat other black people, I think that would be first and foremost moving forward and helping us to solve some of our problems. Just quickly, I wanted to get in because she did mention Mr. Charles Cobb and some of his efforts. I think that he and his father, they were part of the group that was doing some of the workshops in D.C. and bringing different people together. And she was talking about that and how she ended up at this party where she and Dr. Welsing met Mr. Fuller. Mr. Cobb has been a guest on the program. He wrote that this nonviolent stuff will get you killed. He was a guest on the broadcast back in 2014. You can hit the archives. Also, and I have to write about this, I was able to reference Dr. Welsing's work, my most recent post. It's at the blog. It's on Justice Antonin Scalia, who just died over the weekend, where Dr. Welsing was talking about some of his remarks. This is just December, which he was talking about where he was on the bench and they were having the decision about affirmative action. And Justice Scalia said that, you know, most of the top black scientists, they tend to come from lesser schools anyway. He said this on the bench. And again, just December, this is real recent. He went on to say that, you know, it's too taxing. Black people have their, you know, puny peanut-sized Negro brains. It's Black History Month, right? George Washington Carver. They're, you know, we don't want to stress and strain them, having them at some Ivy League institute that was really made for white folks. You know, it probably would be best that they, you know, attend some little, as Dr. Welsing described it, some little nursery school, law school. That would be better for them, and that would be more in line with what we're going to allow them to do anyway. What Dr. Welsing said at her last Welsing Institute talking about Justice Scalia, but I was able to put that in the blog post as well as a fascinating segment from Ned and Constance Sublett, Racist Suspects, because they had a pretty profound passage in their book. They were just on the program last week where they also were talking about Antonin Scalia and his originalism, the way he interprets the Constitution, and that being directly connected to terrorizing black people. But I was able to include that as well. You can check out the post for more information. But the thing I wanted to make sure I got in, the reason I wanted to ensure that Lauren Kress-Love, that she touched on her experience in SNCC, she shared that with me over the weekend where she said that these young racists, young whites who came down to Mississippi and were doing Freedom Summer. This is the summer where James Chaney and those two white boys were killed. And she said that, you know, it would be like, oh my gosh, we just want to thank and praise these white people. I think the word she used was adore. I thought that was poignant word choice, adore. These young whites, young racists who come down here to do this work. And, you know, it was black people that were dying all the time who put, you know, all kinds of things on the line. And, you know, still this worship, this praise of white people. And the immediate thought that came to my mind was, isn't that Bernie Sanders? I hear all this talk about Representative John Lewis, who said, hey, I never saw Bernie Sanders. Like, I don't know who the guy is. You know, him talking all this about what he did during the 60s in the civil rights movement. And he came back and tried to give additional context to his statement. I saw today they were talking about that and other people. At the end of the day, regardless of who you're voting for, I don't care if it's, I look at Bernie Sanders the same way I look at Justice Scalia, the same way I look at Donald Trump, the same way I look at Timothy Wise. I suspect he's white. I suspect he's racist. Maybe he'll do some of the things he's talking about. Maybe he won't even get the nomination. But if he does and he is elected, I expect that he's racist, and that'll be reflected in his term as president if he even gets that far. And that's about all I would have to say about it. I wouldn't spend a whole lot of time jumping up and down, arguing if people want to vote for him. Fine. If you think he's going to do some of these things that might be a little bit better for black people, fine. But at the end of the day, I suspect he's still a racist. And I think that is the logical position to take. Definitely wanted to make sure I get that in and to write that up exactly that way, because that is what popped into the brain computer and talking to her and hearing her experience in SNCC, that is totally Bernie Sanders. And you can apply that to any of these other white people that are running around and talking about how much of an ally they have been to black people. With that, if there is anything folks wanted to make sure they got in before we wrap, we're pretty much at 3-hour mark, so you have to probably keep it to a sentence or two. If there's anything you wanted to get in briefly before we conclude things, you can feel free. The folks who dialed in with a hand up should be with us. Do you have a quick sentence or so that you wanted to get in?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
With Miss Love on the line, I was like very overwhelmed. I'm kind of happy that my question was answered because another caller asked something along the same lines because of her voice sounding so similar, especially when she would say in other words, it was like having Dr. Frances Quest Wesley on the line. So it was like I'm still a little shaken up by it and then still trying to absorb some of the things that she was saying, some of that history that she was giving, and some of the just the emphasis on that black self-respect. So, you know, it was a very good program. I will be listening to the archives and hoping that more of her work, if she's able to find it, that that will kind of manifest and that it'll be made public, you know, soon. So thank you. I'll mute my line.
Right on, right on.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, Gus, I want to mirror what the previous speaker was saying. I'm going to immediately listen to this in the archives. Her voice is just so soothing, and she's just as calm as Dr. Welsing. And to hear her wisdom, she's a living library, just like Dr. Welsing was a living library. And I actually wrote to you during the show, like, you have to have her back, because just to be able to tap into that wellspring of ancestral wisdom is just incredible. And I thank you for this show. Thank you for all the shows, but this show is just really special to me. And thanks again. I'll mute my line.
Right on, right on.
Gus, I wanted to say, I think her mentioning her father and how he put her on melanocytes, I want to kind of emphasize that, like, he put her on the thing. Like, that's so important, right? That is so important for people to study. So, you know, if you're dealing with young people and stuff like that, I think we should be definitely studying that, because it's new groundbreaking science right now, and it's so important to understand that, like, you know, as far as white people and black people, you know what they you know what their problem is, like, it's just I mean, for her to say that, I was like in kind of shock that she brought that up, and I don't know if she even knew, like, how the implications of and how important that is, but I was thinking, like, maybe a little subconsciously she knew that that was important, but I guess it was a fact of history and she just brought it out. But man, that ain't no joke. Her father, whew, man, putting her up on that back in the day. You know, I read these things like books, you know, and Dr. Wilson was that book, the ISIS paper. I mean, she was ahead of her time. Like, people were coming out with these so-called new discoveries and stuff like that. Man, Dr. Wilson was saying, I mean, she was saying a lot of that, a lot of this stuff, man, in her book. I can't even believe it, man. Like, it's just amazing, man. It's amazing. But anyway, yeah, that was, thanks for giving us the opportunity to speak with her.
Absolutely. Can't believe more details. If I That would definitely be one do-over to ask Dr. Welsing more questions about her family, just to dig at some of those details to get that. But I'm glad we had her sister here to provide some of that. But her father, again, Dr. Henry Noah Kress, Dr. Welsing, and Lauren Kresslove's father, Dr. Henry Noah Kress. Yeah, definitely important. Get as much information. I think I've told some of our listeners that before. That's one way you can teach your children about racism. You'd be amazed at some of the information you can get from parents. And just to add that as an addendum, I think that's also one of the reasons, or one of the major detriments of racism, white supremacy, where you have a system where white people conceal a lot of information and keep us from getting adequate education, whether they don't allow us to go to school at all, or whether they just put us, warehouse us in really decrepit schools, either or, just making sure that we do not have adequate information. When you become a parent, then you do not have adequate information to pass on to your children. Just if you could imagine not having a system of racism, white supremacy, and the amount of knowledge and information you could get from your parents. I mean, just right there, that is amazing, to be able to, whatever it is that you're working on and doing, and to be able to just go to dad, mom, boop, they can hook you up. Got it. No problem. Check this out and send you on your way. All kinds of astronomical concepts and ideas and what have you. I think racists have really done a job to limit the amount of constructive info that we have to pass on to our offspring. But yeah, was anybody else have anything they wanted to make sure they get in before we wrap things up?
You know, when I thought about Gus, when Nanana was just talking, when he brought up the fact that Dr. Welsing's father taught her about melanocytes, and I thought about it, like, how long ago, the time frame that this was coming up in her family, and it made me think immediately of Richard Williams and Serena and Venus, and just that parental input and that influence, and how kind of like that was part of the genesis of what became Dr. Welsing that we know and love today. And that was just a fleeting thought that came when I was listening to him speak. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For the folks that are in Chicago, you should maybe go check out the DuSable Museum of African American History. She talked about that, and the founder, Margaret Burroughs, was she black female with natural hair in the 50s? Where she said she was the only person in Chicago. And Chicago has lots of black people. Chicago may have had more black people at that time in 1957 than they do today, 2016. The number has been, because they, as she said, they have been moving black people out of areas like Chicago and Washington, D.C. But I would definitely go to, if I was in Illinois, I would go check out the DuSable Museum of African American History and even learn more information about who Margaret Burroughs is, who she was, what she did. Just incredible wealth of knowledge from Dr. Welsing's sister, Lauren Kresslove. Anybody else that we missed who had commentary they wanted to make sure they got in?
Hey, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Yeah, I agree with what everyone said. Astonishing how, I guess not astonishing, they're sisters, and they're only a year apart or so, but how closely they resemble each other in their tone and demeanor. Also, I had happened to go to the supermarket last night, and I came home, and my daughter was watching the Grammy Awards. So I was making jokes, you know, this the White Awards, you know, making my normal jokes, you know, about something like this. And all of a sudden they did a play about Alexander Hamilton. Now, I just wanted to know if you were familiar with this play, Gus, or any of the callers, because it had a lot of black people in it, and it appeared like a non-white person was playing Alexander Hamilton. And I just wanted to know if anyone had thoughts on that. And I'll mute my line. Thank you for the show, Gus.
I didn't see the Grammys. I don't, you know, make time to watch people's awards, white people's award programs, what have you. So I didn't see the play. And
I don't either, but it's just so happy. You know, I was joking with the kids, because my kids, they do. And I understand, because I, you know, couldn't wait to see Michael in them when I was a kid. But You know, it just so happened right at that moment, Alexander Hamilton. I'm like, the dude on a $10 bill? So I'm like, you know, I'm really in tune because I saw the black people and they didn't look like they were slaves. So I'm like, well, time out. So I just wanted, you know, that was all my observation was about it.
Oh, did anything stick out with what you saw that they performed? I assume they didn't do the whole play, so whatever part of it they decided to read.
Well, what stuck out was they were rapping. And I was like, they rapping? And this is a play about Alexander Hamilton. And then they did mention slavery, and I guess they were going through his life. And, you know, I really wasn't 100% sitting down paying attention to the rhyme, but I was just so like, man, everyone is black. Except for a few people, and then there's a lot of non-black Latinos. And then when the guy who actually is Alexander Hamilton came out, he's definitely not a white person. Well, at least if I show this picture to a white person, I doubt they would accept that he was a white person. So that's what stood out to me, was Alexander Hamilton was black. So I had to start doing research, and I'm like, man, I pull out a $10 bill, like, nah, you don't look black. So I was just curious if you had heard anything, because you're usually up on stuff like that, or, you know, you probably read something in the Times or whatever about it, because I'd never heard of the play or anything until yesterday.
I hadn't heard of the play either. Gus gets an F on that one as well, because I hadn't heard of the play, even though just a little bit of checking online about it since you mentioned it. Apparently this has been a really big phenom, and people have been going to check this play out for some time and talking about it and all that. I don't get out to the theater much, so yeah, didn't know that this was a big cultural event, that you're supposed to be up on this and know about this. But yeah, I didn't know that aspect, or the aspect that they performed some aspect of it last night. I guess it's online, so if people are interested, you can watch the performance to see if, you know, as you're saying, the cast that they had to do this, it seemed like a lot of non-white people. So if folks are interested, you can check that out and kind of see if anything stands out, or why they cast it in this way, or even who were the people performing. If they were particular musicians who decided to do this for a reason. I guess they have a lot of commentary online. So feel free to do more research.
Hey Gus, I'm reading this bestseller. I read it already, but a couple months ago. And one of the so-called groundbreaking parts of the book, it was talking about the glute muscles and how we wouldn't be able to walk upright or run without the glutes. That you know, this is supposed to be like this new discovery, and how, you know, like this has this, you know, this groundbreaking thing for the human being. Dr. Wellesing broke that down in detail in the ISIS papers. I mean, this is what it is, okay? So, I mean, that book ain't no joke. So, not at all. I hope people, you know, give it to their kids or read it with them and break it. Not take it as no joke, you know what I'm saying, as far as, oh, black people got big butts and stuff like that. Like, she went into it, and white people are writing about how important that is, and, you know, selling books, flying off the shelf. So I just wanted to add that.
Not surprised. She was a third-generation physician. I would say she had just an amazing wealth of knowledge about a lot of things. I think her sister commented about the amount of books and reading and research that she had, and notes all over the house. She seemed to be incredibly curious about lots of things. So I'm not surprised at all. That's why I suspect people will be referencing her for quite a few years to come. Just the things that she was talking about, even things she was talking about right up to the time that she transitioned, being relevant right now. So it does not surprise me at all. And I can only, because her sister said that too, when I was talking to her on Saturday, she was saying there's so many people talk about Dr. Wellesing and they know the ISIS papers, but they haven't read the book, and or they haven't really studied it and really, you know, take taken the time to comprehensively analyze what she was saying and then look at the application factor in terms of, okay, I really grasp the concepts that she's setting forth and what she's talking about, and then I go out into the world and see how that fits and apply that to my thinking and, you know, see if it makes sense. I mean, just really, really taking the time to take it as serious scholarship. So I suspect folks do that, you will be stunned over and over and over again. Just incredible, years ahead of her time, and just the immense knowledge that she had. Third generation physician, can't say, and that should be kept in mind. Any of her theories that you're thinking about, it's not saying you have to agree with everything, but her views on use of cannabis, her thoughts about the upcoming presidential election, her thoughts about white genetic annihilation. Third generation physician, not just up here talking crazy like I woke up this morning and, you know, had an idea while I was brushing my teeth. No, third generation physician. We've been doing this in our family for a while now.
You know, Gus, speaking to what Thomas in New York was just bringing up, I'm wondering if Alexander Hamilton has some black ancestry, because I didn't see the play. I didn't know about the play either, and I didn't see the Grammys last night. But I know there's been quite a few scholars that discussed the fact that before Barack Obama, there were at least six presidents of the United States that did have African blood. Matter of fact, the Huffington Post has an article about those six presidents, and it just made me think of that. He's not on the list of the presidents, but I'm wondering if maybe there was some discovery of him having some African ancestry somewhere. But I just wanted to throw that out there. Thank you.
Wouldn't be surprised. wouldn't shock me at all. White people do a great job of making up the classifications as they go, as, you know, white. It's just a political classification that they loosely base around biology, so it wouldn't stun me in the least little bit. And there's been so much rape going on. Again, Ned and Constance Sublett, their book we discussed last week, but there's been so much rape of black people going on, and so many of the what they call founding fathers, Dr. Welsing called them fondling fathers, so many of them were torturers, terrorists, rapists of black people, that, you know, it should be no shock at all. But again, folks, there's a lot of detail. This apparently is one of the big trending topics over the last 24 hours since the Grammys, so you can check it out for folks if you want to see, you know, what the actual actors look like, and then you can see different people that have different theories on why they did that segment and why the cast looked the way it did in terms of them having non-white people playing those particular parts. But check it out if you find anything interesting. Feel free, share. You can post it on the Facebook group, or if you want to send it my way, feel free. With that, we did our three. I am hoping to have guests from the UK on this week, sometime before Friday, hopefully, to discuss the case with Sarah Reed. I don't know if as many people heard, because this happened obviously overseas, but it was just, you know, Sandra Bland, Kimberly Randall King, a black female who was in custody and ended up dead under suspicious circumstances. She had been communicating with her family before her death that she did not feel safe and that she was under attack from the officials at the institute where she was in confinement, and then ended up dead after she had been communicating this to her family. But they have been advocating on her behalf and trying to get publicity to this case for the past few weeks or so. So I'm hoping to have some of the folks who are representing the family come on the program to give us more of the detail, just so that we understand this as a global problem of terrorism against black people. Obviously, it would be much earlier than our normal broadcast time because of the time difference. So I'll try and get the details if we can make it happen, get those details as soon as possible. And then if you're able to tune in early, great. If not, it'll be in the archives. But hopefully we can get that done within the next few days. Regardless, we'll be here for the book club. Dr. Welsing's sister, Miss Lauren Quest Love, she talked about that on the broadcast, the importance of having study groups. Friday, the book club, we're winding down. The half has never been told. I think we should have two sessions left and then we're done. But that's Friday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Compensatory call-in is Saturday. And then Sunday is our global Sunday talk on racism. Hopefully we'll have lots of folks from different parts of the planet tuning in to kind of share their views, what's been happening over the first 2 months, basically, of 2016. But that'll be Saturday, early broadcast, 12 noon Eastern, 11 a.m. Central, 9 a.m. Pacific. We'll be looking forward to chatting it up Sunday morning, afternoon, depending on where you are. But with that, thanks to everyone for tuning in. I hope it was great being able to hear from Dr. Welsing's sister. I will follow up with her for sure to get the details for the event in March. If anyone is planning on attending, I will get the details out as soon as I know. Exact details, time, and all that, if there's, you know, anything else that's pertinent that folks need to know. But I'll be sure that, you know, people have it well in advance of March 19th, next month. With that, thanks for folks tuning in. Invest if you think the program is constructive. We are fundraising for 2016. The blog is racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. You will see Dr. Welsing's quote about Justice Scalia. It's the top blog post on the page. You'll see that on the right side of the page. You'll see the PayPal button. Invest. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email and we'll get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested, supported us down through the years. Hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. With that, I will say again, sobriety would be best under conditions of war. You do not want to be behind the wheel and have that be the day that Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson pulls you over. We want to be clear, lucid, so we can make the best possible decisions to keep ourselves safe and any of the folks that we might be responsible for. I discourage being around intoxicated whites and even intoxicated non-whites. Frequently, we just don't make great decisions. We already have enough problems. We do not need any unnecessary and easily avoidable difficulties in our life. Buckle up if you're going to get behind the wheel. I say that all the time. They have reports that come out almost on a weekly basis about how they have tons of information. Black people are disproportionately stopped and ticketed for seatbelt violations. That is just, you're giving them an easy opportunity to come and harass and torture you. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. Buckle up your seatbelt every time, driver, passenger, whatever. Buckle up if you are in a vehicle, standard codification. With that, it has been time. Creator, remind us to be patient with other victims of white supremacy. Remind us to be patient with ourselves. Make sure that our conduct reflects that black people, including ourselves, do not qualify for mental health under the system of white supremacy. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows, signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.